Okay, so welcome to this podcast that we're doing for INDR. I'm very pleased to welcome and introduce Krista Austin. Krista's a sports scientist who's worked in a number of different sports and in a number of different countries with some very high-performing elite athletes who are kind of at the international level of competition. So we're very pleased to have her contribution in what hopefully will be a kind of wide-ranging discussion. So thanks, Krista, for joining us. So I'd just like to also introduce April Henning, who works at University of Stirling, and Jörg Krieger, who works at Aarhus University in Denmark, and they will be joining me on this conversation as well. So I'll just kick things off, Krista, if that's okay, by asking what you think are the most pressing issues facing anti-doping organizations at the moment.
Well, first and foremost, I think the biggest issue is funding. Secondly, I would say it's the question regarding medication that may allow athletes to hang on, or we don't know their effects. We don't understand them completely. And then the third is to ensure equivocal testing across the board. One of the biggest things that I know means a lot to the athletes here in the U.S. is, you know, how many times is someone tested before they hit that podium? How frequently can they be tested? So when we have limitations in funding, it's one of those issues that consistently comes up over and over again.
Yeah, and so what's the kind of funding? I mean, where would you see the funding issue being addressed? Because often WADA say it's not their responsibility, they're kind of the coordination body, and testing has to be funded by sports organizations. So how would you see that going?
Well, I think that, you know, interesting, and I understand WADA's perspective on that. I think one thing that could be done is to tap into more government resources to see if we couldn't use some of the research funding there to specifically direct it towards the anti-doping efforts. A lot of the questions that people come to me with, I often say, well, if we had the funding to do that, absolutely, we could take a look. But at this point in time, we don't have that. So here in the U.S., we have a program called the WCAP, the World Class Athlete Program. And I think oftentimes that's where the government has put a little support towards sport. But they definitely, I think, could put a lot more. Okay. And so if there was ever a way to turn around and say, okay, we have the WCAP, how do we expand on this and help support our athletes better, help support the anti-doping efforts more so, because they do a lot of research anyway. I think that's one avenue we could go down. The other is when we have really large companies sponsoring athletes, asking them to put the funding into a nonprofit of some sort that helps to address issues that athletes often encounter. And oftentimes what happens is they sponsor the athlete, they take care of a salary for a short period of time, and then they don't help them also enrich the sport, I guess you could say, and make it better by donating towards things that we really need to look at, whether it's anti-doping or their health or something else of that nature. So I think there's potential there. We just have to draw people to it.
Yeah. And just on your question then about testing and, you know, the harmonization and the frequency of testing, I mean, you've kind of mentioned that already. Would you like to elaborate a little bit on that, just from, you know, a kind of fairly scientific point of view?
Yeah, I mean, so if we take a look at a lot of the substances that are out there, and we'll just take one that's easy to identify, right? And that is, let's say, testosterone. If you just show up on the day of competition and use it, I don't know how beneficial that actually is. Most of what happens for an athlete occurs in training. And so if they're using it in training, then they're probably going to get their greatest benefit from a substance like that. At least that's my perspective. And so what happens is oftentimes athletes get tested once, and that's when they podium somewhere, and they don't do the actual out-of-sport competition testing enough to truly detect these substances, which oftentimes you need that, so that they don't just show up to the race and never test positive. And so really, there's a lot of questions around that here in the U.S. They will watch someone podium at a race, notice that they've served a ban even, maybe. And then they look back and realize that the one time the person was actually tested, they tested positive. And they said, well, why isn't this person being tested on a regular basis? And usually I have to say, look, it's a funding issue. If we don't have the funding that we need, they only go in and they test this upper echelon really regularly, when in all reality, we need to be testing, you know, very early on in the process, especially because of a lot of it has to do with gains and training adaptation. And because we don't have a good gauge on that factor with most athletes, we have to use out of competition testing right now to help understand, are they tolerating extreme training loads? Is there something going on there? So that's our current method for really saying, are they doing something in training they shouldn't be doing?
Yeah.
And that's where the frustration, I think, comes in for a lot of athletes, is that they don't realize that until you're put into a testing pool or you podium at a major race, that may be the only time they get tested, especially if they're new to the sport or they're an anomaly. You know, it just, it's something that definitely needs more funding.
Yeah. So I was interested in one of the things you mentioned there about frequency of testing and trying to monitor people's training. And I think I'd quite like to come back to the kind of science of that in a few minutes. But one of the most pressing issues at the moment, of course, is the restrictions of access that, you know, we're all facing. And I'm just wondering if you've heard much or seen much really that indicates that anti-doping is struggling, you know, to get the testing organized in the current conditions that we're in?
You know, I haven't heard a whole lot, just because all you really see in the press at the moment is that you've got this upper echelon again that USADA, at least here in the US, is focusing on. Yeah. And that they've got this Zoom type testing protocol that they're utilizing. Now, it could leave a lot of loopholes, I would think, because if you're not there with them, you know, because usually they show up unannounced. With Zoom, I would think you'd actually have to be a lot more notified to make sure you could get on the Zoom video chat and what have you with regards to the testing. I'm not sure 100% how they're doing that. But at the end of the day, if you can't get two athletes and test them, they could be doing whatever it is that they choose to do. Now, here in the U.S., I don't know that everywhere is so restricted that they, you know, could not show up and then have a protocol where the tester is actually there. There's just precautions taken, you know, such as making sure the tester does not have COVID-19 or antibodies, you know, testing for that kind of nature. And then also with the athlete as well, possibly. I don't know how they're going to refine it, but I will just tell you, there's very little understanding as to what's truly going on. There's just a little bit of press, and it leaves a lot of questions that the athletes already have when athletes are not tested frequently. So I just say, you know, for right now, you have to kind of ignore it and just accept that hopefully everyone's competing clean and go about doing your best to, you know, do what you need to do. I mean, even the concept of Zwift, right? So here's this Zwift racing, and I saw an article the other day where an athlete was saying there's no way this is legitimate. Yeah. And one of the athletes, you know, brought it to my attention, and I said, you know what? Go on Zwift, train, do your best. You're not going to make any money doing it anyway. This is a training tool. And then be prepared, hopefully, in the near future, by the end of the year or next year, to go out and compete. It's all we can really do for them at this point.
Yeah, so just coming back to the point you're making, so do you think there's a wider, another option for anti-doping, which is really about monitoring performance? And, you know, if so, I mean, how practical is that? How accurate would it be? How kind of watertight would it be? You know, what's your kind of thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, one of the things that I've had some discussions with colleagues previously about is just, you know, how do you know that a substance is truly benefiting someone, right? Because they'll always sit there and say, well, how would that ever benefit that athlete? And I said, you know, we don't really know until we take a look at their tolerance to training loads and their overall state of health. And that's one of the things that has been questioned, right, here recently with a medication like even thyroid hormone that is not banned, and we don't know a whole lot about it. We've never really studied it to see if it can enhance performance. And they asked me, they said, well, how would you know if it did? How would you know if someone was abusing it? And I said, honestly, you would have to have training load data on that athlete, at this point in time anyway, I said, to try and demonstrate that it's enhancing performance and that in some way or another they're violating that spirit of sport. And then also, you know, triggering things within their body that harms their health, right? So I said, one of the big questions around it is, can it be abused? And if you take a look at a lot of what we do in sport is we say, okay, what does the research literature tell us about testosterone, right? Well, it tells us that if you increase the levels, you can increase muscle mass. And therefore we say, well, it has the potential in sport to enhance performance, right? That also, based on the research literature, has the ability to harm their health. But given the issues surrounding all of this, you know, I just say, look, if we had the ability to monitor an athlete for training load, then we could far more so probably detect if they are doping. And it would be a more non-invasive, it could be very remote, but the question is, how do you do that? And how do you do it with a high level of validation? And I think that's really where, you know, we have to sit back and say, would WADA or another agency who does funding ever invest in something that's not out of the, you know, molecular or biochemical lab, right? If you take a look at a lot of the research that's funded, that's where it's spent because they're trying to catch substances. Whereas the whole concept of training load is very different, right? So can we take systems like Training Peaks, where we start in a sport like cycling, where you can calibrate the power meter, you can put heart rate monitors on them, you have a robust system like Training Peaks that has a lot of strong metrics that these athletes use anyway for training purposes, and can we, with validation processes with scientists, physiologists like myself, yourself, begin to identify through big data that we do have possible doping going on even from afar? Now, you then have to get into things like, how do you ensure that the data is theirs? Okay. And people have said, well, how do you do that? I said, well, you'd have to actually turn around and have some type of identifier, such as retinal identification or facial identification, that triggers the device, making sure the device is, you know, well within, you know, where the person is at, right, to help ensure that the data you're collecting is actually theirs. Because otherwise, you know, you may, you know, collect somebody else's data and never know that that's what happened. Has there been any funding put into that? Not to my knowledge. I don't know if you guys are aware of any, but I think it would be, you know, the next big step in actual anti-doping. You know, talking to some colleagues will say, well, yes, Krista, that's the utopia, is tolerance to extreme loads. But I think, you know, you're kidding yourself if you try to go down this road or say that that's what will be a benefit. And I said, well, we've never tried it, though. So the question is, can we try it in a sport where we can calibrate and begin to develop and validate methods that might give us some greater insight and that can regularly be monitored on someone?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, it's not, I think it's quite early days for that, but I think, you know, all of us who are involved in the international network have often thought about how anti-doping developed over time. And in some ways it developed, as you say, around substances rather than around the impact of those substances. And so the science and the policy is really about, did an athlete take something that's on the list, yes or no, rather than did they take something and did they actually achieve any outcome because they took it? Did it change the result of any event because they took this drug? And in my mind, if it hasn't, then what's the point in punishing them? They've not achieved anything. Nobody's lost anything, you know, but then you could have had a different paradigm of how the science was organized around that. So rather than, as you say, look at molecular level and metabolites and trace amounts of, you know, substances that may or may not even have changed their performance, you know, they could have done it differently. So,
right.
But anyway, so
I think, the questions that'll come around that though is, you know, are you invading the athlete's privacy?
Yeah.
You know, are they a criminal with, you know, an ankle monitor on all of a sudden, right? And the question is, can you do it without invading their privacy? And is there an additional benefit, like improving the health of the athlete and maintaining it long term? Because even in those athletes that turn around, and we know in the you know, Krista, is there any way for you to prevent this from happening to us? And I said, only if I could readily early on know your training and your nutrition could I maybe have helped to prevent it. So if we could ever justify it from that perspective as well as athlete health and long-term career optimization and protecting them, because it is stressful, right? Just with the whole financial side of it and what have you, then I think that's, you know, probably worth it at that point.
Well, that's all. Yeah, really interesting. Thanks. I just wanted to, if you don't mind, just touch upon another subject, which I think that, you know, we'd discussed in a previous conversation, which is about athletes who are really at a different level of competition. So athletes may be working in, you know, masters age group, older age group competitions, or maybe they're just at a lower level of performance, or maybe they're in their early career stage. And I just wonder how, you know, if you think anti-doping organizations and policies are protecting those athletes, are they giving them sufficient information? And equally, is there enough testing? Is there enough control mechanisms?
Yeah, so when I think about that age group, right, that level of competitor, the first thing that I go back to is, you know, why was the code developed in the first place? And correct me if I'm wrong, but it was meant to ensure people's health was maintained and ensure a fair field of play, right? So I go back to the first part, which is health. And when I look at the level of education that we're able to offer athletes and the amount of resource that we have, at least here in the U.S., we're already very spread thin, okay? And if you talk to most of them, they're not necessarily aware of the code even, all right? And so first and foremost, when I look at that group, I say, if we're going to test them, what are our processes to help ensure that they are educated and we don't find something that they didn't know was coming or that they never intended to dope, right? But maybe a medical provider prescribed something that they have no idea about the code. They didn't know the athlete was even competing in a sport at any level where they would be tested. And all of a sudden, we do something to their life that actually harms their health, right? Especially by making the violation public, okay? And I remember one athlete telling me once, and I never realized it, was the impact on psychological health and how they just felt like blowing the brains out when it happened. And in fact, you know, they had been to their coach and said, hey, this is what my medical physician placed me on. And they were an age grouper and eventually, you know, went to the pro level and ended up serving a ban because of it. And I never realized until then, and when they talked about the cost, how much we had probably actually hurt that athlete's health. You know, the athlete had really been failed because the education process was not there. And so what I actually sometimes talk to coaching education managers about is when I see situations like that, you know, what can you guys be doing to create the high level of touch points within your budget the code and the potential for testing at different levels? And oftentimes it's only if the coach actually catches it and they go, oh, wait a minute, you know, is this something, you know, that even a young athlete who's maybe going to be treated for growth hormone deficiency, they have no idea. The parents don't. The physician doesn't. And they've caught it just in time to prevent an adverse situation for the athlete. So that's first and foremost. The second might be, especially with the way physicians are treating from a medical perspective today, is that the anti-doping organization may find it to be performance enhancing and have a particular view of it, correct? Whereas the physician may say, no, this is actually, in my opinion, the best route of treatment for this individual. Okay. And the medical benefit, in their opinion, is far more valid than the anti-doping process. I don't know how much of that would actually occur, but I just kind of take a look at how many TUEs are applied for and how many are actually granted. And when TUEs are not granted, the question is that because anti-doping rules say one thing and physicians are saying another? And the question is, how much is that happening with actual age groupers? And what I notice about age groupers is that they don't know that they may be tested or that the code exists. And so that's what's really tough. They're participating in sport for their health and to enjoy it and for social purposes. And usually if you went in and asked them, you know, is this why you're participating? They would say, oh no, I just wanted to go with my friends and maybe I happen to be good at it. I think one of the solutions might be, before they enter a race, say, do you want to fall into X category in which we may take a look at you through the anti-doping code? Or are you here just for fun and with your friends and you don't want to be considered for testing, or for your result to count for like an age group nationals or something? And then they're put on alert immediately at the entry into the competition, right? That these two different worlds exist. I don't know, it's an approach, but I know that the education level would need to significantly increase even if we did that, and somehow we'd have to have the resource, especially financially, to hire people to do, you know, all the education process that's really needed and to help stay on top of it with the athletes, because they forget. They might say yes at one point in time, and we're all like this. We go down the road and we go, oh wait, I forgot about this, and there's always these, exceptions or what have you. And you can only imagine the age group are running into that and forgetting last minute, maybe because they have five kids and the sport's actually their release and they want to try to be a little on the competitive side while also being a parent. How do we make sure there's never anything adverse that harms their life and career? I don't know.
I think those are all really important issues. And I always remember a story of an elite cyclist who was buying cod liver oil, and he was buying it from a store in a city centre somewhere. And the nutritionist said, it's okay to take that, but don't use that bottle, because even the bottle might be contaminated with what was in it before. So the level of support that's at the elite level, the amount of support that's at the elite level for athletes to ensure that there's no possible contamination, they've had their supplements batch tested, there's no recycling of bottles or whatever, and you're applying the same codes, the same rules, the same regulations to people who don't have anything like that level of support. And I just think it's not comparing the same things, but you're applying the same rules. And, I have spoken to some athletes myself who just felt like exactly what you were saying. They were doing something at weekends that they enjoyed with their friends, and all of a sudden, for no reason that they can understand, they've been told they can't do that for 2 years. And it's just amazing, because the impact on them is so profound, as you say. It's not about health anymore, it's about policing, and policing the wrong people. Anyway, sorry, it's not my interview. So, I'm just wondering if anybody's got any other questions or issues that they want to explore. Okay, good. So I'll just wrap up, if that's okay, Krista, by saying thank you very much. It's all very interesting, and I hope some of your ideas develop, because obviously I think the key thing that you keep coming back to is health and the protection of athletes' health, and just getting that balance is really essential. So thank you for your time, and thank you for your expert contribution.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. Appreciate the time.
Okay, take care.